It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, thanks for joining. Before we get started, please make sure you have subscribed to follow us on all the various platforms we're publishing on, here on the podcast, as well as on YouTube, the written stuff on Substack, as well as the quick takes on Instagram and on Threads. Please make sure you're giving us that 5-star rating, giving us a big thumbs up, like, sharing out all of the various publications that we're putting out there with all your friends and families. Anything you can do to help us spread the word that we're doing is greatly appreciated. As we slowly move in the calendar and head into summer, we've talked about how safe is it to quickly lose weight in order to get that body image we've been trying to get in case we haven't been able to reach our goals based off of the long-term goals we set for ourselves in our New Year's resolution, in which we know that we can go ahead and do some quick periodization style modifications to our diet in order to kind of kickstart the weight loss and the body image changing that we've been hoping to get throughout the year in order to make us feel a little bit better about ourselves as we head into the summer season. But that's only one aspect of the overall issues that relate to summer and the desire to be outside and the desire to be more active as the summer months hit us. And so what we have to do is we have to take a step back and think about, okay, what things do we need to do in order to kind of foolproof ourselves and make sure that we're able to continue to progress in our goals for being healthy and stay healthy during the summer months as we become more active outside. So let's go ahead and take a quick look at some of the various things that we can do in order to make ourselves continue to stay healthy in the summer months. And then we'll revisit a previous discussion about the issues of hydration and some of the myths and misconceptions out there as it relates to what kind of beverages we should or should not be consuming in the summer months if we hope to stay hydrated as the weather changes and becomes warmer. So staying healthy during the summer, let's talk about that.
Warning. The following presentation contains information that might contradict what you have previously heard, or believed to be true, about how the human body works, and contains material that is not suitable for closed-minded individuals. Enjoy!
So as we head into the summer, we have to remember a couple of things about really environmental issues that are going to come into play as it relates to our ability to stay healthy, and what we need to do in order to make sure that we don't get compromised in terms of our overall health, either short-term or long-term, due to the environment that we're going to face during the summer. We know that being outdoors is beneficial. It has a beneficial effect in terms of our general mood, in terms of reducing stress, in terms of improving cardiovascular health, in terms of improving musculoskeletal health, in terms of improving neurological health, all based off of increasing our level of activity, as well as the general environmental signals that come into play from increased sunlight that changes a lot of hormones, a lot of neurotransmitters, that kind of puts us more at ease and reduces our overall general level of stress. But the problem is that being outdoors has potential risks to it. One of the biggest risks that we're going to face during the summer is dehydration issues, and we'll hold off of that until we revisit our discussion on hydration here in a second. A lot of times we start looking at issues as it relates to summertime. It has a lot to do with sun exposure and the impact that sun exposure has on our body. When we look at sun exposure, we have to look at it both in terms of short-term exposure as well as long-term exposure. The short-term exposure that we have to the summer environment has to deal with two big issues. And the first big issue is that hydration issue, but the other big issue that we have to deal with in terms of the short-term is heat and the need to stay within a very narrow window of body temperature. And that very narrow window of body temperature is about 4 degrees centigrade in terms of where I can function appropriately, where I can function optimally, my homeostatic sense of body temperature being normal, and the point at which I hit heat exhaustion and heat stroke. And so a lot of the precautions that we're going to talk about here is about making sure that we don't reach that 4 degrees centigrade elevation. And that 4 degrees centigrade elevation is going to basically impact a lot of the choices that we're going to make. One of the ways in which we can make sure that we're not going to have the excessive heat issues is to make sure that we're wearing appropriate clothing. Now, appropriate clothing is not only going to help us with the heat issues, but it's also going to help us with sun protection, which is one of the long-term issues that we have to worry about when we start looking at being outdoors during the summertime and the long-term risk of developing skin cancer due to exposure to sunlight, in particular the ultraviolet light, the UVA, UVB light rays that we get exposed to during time spent outdoors. And so when we start looking at clothing that we want to wear, we want to make sure that we're doing two things. Number one, we want to make sure that we're choosing appropriate clothing to wear, but also choosing the appropriate amount of clothing to wear. And it's kind of a catch-22 because we want to have clothing to protect ourselves from sun exposure, but we don't want to have so much clothing that we trap heat on our body, causing us to become excessively warm. Because once again, we only have that 4 degrees centigrade window of space that we can play with in terms of staying within our normal range for body temperature. So what are some of the recommendations we can have as it relates to clothing? Well, the first thing we want to make sure that we're wearing are clothing that is loose fitting, that is light in color, that is light in material weight. We can use cotton, we can use cotton fabrics, we can use mixture fabrics, synthetic fabrics in this. What we want to avoid are any type of heavy cotton or multi-layered clothing that can act as a thermal blanketing around the body, particularly during the day. Now, one of the things that we have to worry about during summertime as relates to temperature and body heat issues is not just the overheating issue, but the hypothermic issue, the too low issue, particularly with the fact that during the summertime, we can see very wild swings in air temperature throughout the day. And so one of the things we want to do during the day is wear clothing that is going to limit the amount of absorption of sunlight. That's where we want to make sure we're wearing lighter colored fabrics. We want to make sure that we're wearing fabric that is slightly looser fitting so that we don't get a thermal blanketing effect around the body with the clothing. We want to make sure that we're wearing clothing that is going to allow for us to maximize our ability to evaporatively cool, to sweat without trapping that sweat on the body. And that's where if we start having fabric that's going to hold on to the moisture, hold on to the water within the sweat, it becomes more difficult for us to evaporatively cool because of a phenomenon known as relative humidity, where because we have a wet blanket around us, we might think of that as being a way to cool our body off. The problem is that if we're wearing this wet blanket while we're exercising, it's actually acting like a blanket trap. So it's actually holding on to more heat around the body simply because of the specific heat of water, the amount of heat that is necessary for that water to turn from liquid, from sweat, into steam, evaporative cooling to cool the body off. And so we want to do is we want to make sure that we're wearing clothing that's going to allow us to effectively evaporatively cool. And this is where with the modern fabrics, the wickaway clothing can be of benefit, particularly during the summer, particularly if we're going to be exercising during the summer. Now, some people might take that to an extreme and say, okay, I want to maximize my evaporative cooling, so I'm going to minimize the amount of clothing I'm going to wear. And this is where wearing the appropriate amount of clothing comes into play. And that's because we want to make sure that we're protecting the body, not just from overheating, but also from sun exposure, from environmental exposure, where we want to make sure that we have clothing that's going to protect us from insects, that's going to protect us from dust, from debris that we're going to be interacting with, particularly if, let's say, we're out on a hiking trail. We want to make sure that we're wearing clothing that's going to protect us from any type of insect that might be within the vegetation or around the vegetation. We want to make sure that we're wearing clothing that's going to protect us from any of the grasses, from the dust, from the debris, from the rocks, from anything else that we might interact with. We want to make sure that that clothing is going to, once again, allow us to effectively cool ourselves, even though we are going to be active within the environment. And so clothing becomes important in terms of that kind of duality. We want to protect ourselves from the environment, but at the same time, we want to protect ourselves from ourselves in terms of making sure that we're not going to overheat. Along with that idea about making sure that we're able to get rid of the excess heat that we're building up in our body from being active, we want to make sure that we're giving ourselves time to dissipate, to get rid of heat that is building up in our body. This is where making sure that we are timing breaks within our physical activity becomes important. This is where making sure that those breaks are done in such a way as to minimize the amount of environmental heat that we're picking up during the breaks. Taking breaks where we utilize passive and active cooling mechanisms to help get rid of extra heat. And so when we start looking at this idea, okay, how do I get rid of this excess heat? How do I make sure that I'm not overheating my body? Breaks become very important. Breaks become important. Time of day in which we're being most active become important. The breaks that we're going to take should include breaks where we're out of the sun, where we're out of the environment, where we're utilizing fans, where we're utilizing air conditioning, where we're utilizing ice and cool blankets to help dissipate some of the heat. Now, once again, we don't want to run around with cool blankets on us, but utilizing cool blankets to at points in time to help get rid of extra heat can be a benefit if we're trying to make sure we're not going to overheat. In order to make sure we're not overheating, there's a few things we should be aware of in terms of signs and symptoms that we're starting to overheat. And so what are some of the symptoms that we might exhibit if we're showing heat exhaustion or someone around us is showing heat exhaustion? And so what we remember is that heat exhaustion is the first step towards having a medical issue, heat stroke. And so being aware of these signs and symptoms become very important, particularly during the summertime, particularly if we're not able to exercise at the correct time of day, or if we happen to have a job that makes us have to be outside at the inappropriate times of the day. And so signs and symptoms that we have to be aware of, things like high body temperature, heavy sweating, cool, moist skin, even though we have a high body temperature and have been excessively sweating, a very high heart rate, excessive fatigue, fatigue that goes beyond what we should be experiencing based off of how hard we're working, muscle cramping, dizziness, headache, confusion, nausea, but not vomiting. Simply feeling like you're going to vomit, but not necessarily vomiting is one of the signs of having heat exhaustion. If we start exhibiting heat exhaustion or someone that around us is starting to exhibit heat exhaustion, this is where we have to start to cool down very rapidly, as rapidly as we possibly can, without causing us to start to shiver, which is going to increase our body temperature. This is where getting out of the sun, utilizing fans, utilizing ice towels, utilizing cold water, drinking cold water can be of benefit. If we cannot control the amount of heat during this time, then we have to start worrying about heat stroke issues, and heat stroke issues is a medical emergency. This is where we're going to have excessively high body temperature with hot, flushed skin, but the person has stopped sweating. A lot of times we start getting heat stroke issues. We start getting heat stroke issues because of excessive dehydration accompanying the elevated body temperature due to either excessive exposure to the environment, that is being outside at the inappropriate times of the day, or being excessively active in inappropriate environments. We'll have severe headaches. We'll have possible blurred vision or double vision. We'll have extreme muscle cramping. We'll have nausea with vomiting. The nausea with vomiting in the heat stroke is an attempt to get rid of anything inside of the intestines that might cause additional heat to build up. It's kind of like a safety precaution measure that comes into play. If I go from heat exhaustion to heat stroke, we're now in medical emergency time and it's time to seek medical attention. If I'm simply in heat exhaustion, getting out of the heat, cooling down becomes paramount. So we have to worry about the heat issues in the summertime. Like I said, one of the ways we can take care of that heat issues is making sure that we're in appropriate clothing and the appropriate amount of clothing, taking breaks. We'll cover the hydration issue later on here with the revisit of the hydration discussion. But the other thing we have to worry about, or the other thing we should start looking at, and this goes hand in hand with making sure that we're sometimes referred to as sun safe, which is if we're going to be active and exercise during the summer, exercise and activity should be done either early in the day or late in the day, not in the middle of the day. The middle of the day is typically when we have our peak heat. It's also when we have our peak exposure to sunlight, in particular UV radiation, where if we can change when we're physically active outside, we can go ahead and minimize sun exposure as well as heat and heat buildup within the body during periods of activity. Along with looking at what time of the day to be most active outside in order to compensate for the heat buildup that will come about from being active, the other thing to remember in terms of being sun safe is the idea of SPF and the need to protect our skin from UVA, UVB radiation. When we're talking about SPF, we're really talking about two things. We're talking about clothing once again and utilizing the appropriate clothing, the appropriate amount of clothing, but also utilizing sunscreen. When we're talking about sunscreen, there's a couple of things we have to remember in terms of how to go about applying the sunscreen that a lot of us don't think about. And the first thing we have to remember is that sunscreen should be applied as a coat across the skin and not rubbed into the skin as if we are trying to apply skin lotion. Using the creams is better than using the sprays if we're attempting to get a full coating on the body. We want to make sure that we are reapplying sunscreen based on the SPF value as well as the time that we're spending outdoors. Reapplying SPF sunscreen based off of the amount of water we're coming in contact with, whether it's from sweat or from being in the water itself. Remember that water resistance in terms of SPF only basically gives us about 40 minutes total time, depending upon the value of the SPF. And the value of the SPF is simply giving me how much additional time I have before I have to worry about issues relating to UVA, UVB radiation versus not having any sunscreen on whatsoever. Minimum that you want to have is an SPF 15. However, most recommendations nowadays are around SPF 30. Higher values beyond the 30 is not really of benefit in terms of how much protection you get since we are going to be reapplying or should be reapplying the sunscreen regularly. Making sure that we're wearing appropriate eye protection is also important when we're looking at this kind of sun-safe idea within the summer months, even though we should be really kind of following this eye protection year-round. Sunglasses are of more importance during the summer simply because of the angle and amount of sunlight we might have relative to the other time of the year. Making sure that the sunglasses we are wearing have the UVA, UVB, or broad spectrum UV protection too. And same with the sunscreen, making sure that we're utilizing broad spectrum sun protection as opposed to simply UVA or UVB protection. Utilizing hats is also a recommendation for sun protection. A lot of people think, oh, well, if I wear a hat, then I'm going to be trapping heat into my body because we lose so much heat from our head. And that's not true. That's actually one of the big misconceptions and misnomers out there as it relates to body temperature and body temperature regulation and the need to wear hats in order to fend off being cold during the winter or keeping hats off during the summer so as to not overheat. The amount of heat that gets transferred from the head is minimal relative to the amount of heat that gets transferred from the rest of the body simply because heat transfer is all about surface area. And we don't have a lot of surface area on the head in order to get rid of extra heat. Wearing hats can be protective to the scalp, to the face, to the nape, to the back of the neck. And depending upon whether or not you're wearing a broad brim hat or wearing something like a baseball cap is going to dictate how much protection you get from that hat to other areas besides just the face and just the top of the head. And so those are the kind of the issues that we have to look at in terms of sun protection. Those are the kind of issues we have to look at in terms of clothing and in terms of heat. And so for the rest of the discussion here, let's take a look at the ideas that surround the big major issue that most people discuss when we start looking at being active during the summer months. And that's the necessity to stay hydrated and the hydration issues that can come about during summer months that might be more of an impact during the summer months than during the rest of the year. Part of this idea about hydration and staying hydrated falls into two other kinds of things we have to worry about before we get into the nuts and bolts of the hydration issue. The first one we have to look at is staying fueled and staying fed. In this, we have to remember a couple things. We have to remember to not skip the carbohydrates. Don't skip the sugars during the summer, particularly for looking at trying to stay hydrated and trying to stay hydrated due to excessive exercise or excessive amounts of activity that come about due to longer amounts of daylight that's out there. Carbs and electrolytes, which is why we want to also make sure that we're not skipping the salts in our diet. Carbs and electrolytes act as water sponges in the hydration mechanism. And so we don't want to eliminate carbohydrates, even though carbohydrates in the current diet culture movements tend to get a bad rap. We want to make sure that carbohydrates, sugars are in the diet because we need those sugars to help us with hydration and hydration status. We also need those sugars to make sure that we have appropriate amounts of fuel to go about allowing us to do the exercise and the activities that we're doing throughout the summer. Same thing for the salts. We want to make sure that we are salting our foods, making sure that we are adding electrolytes to the beverages that we are consuming so that we can avert any type of electrolyte imbalance causing hydration issues that can lead to cramping or loss of optimal performance due to lack of hydration. We want to make sure that we are not skipping meals. Skipping meals, which once again is a kind of popular diet culture aspect within our society right now. Skipping meals puts us into a ketogenic state, and a ketogenic state can have impacts on both our heat metabolism as well as our hydration status, our ability to stay normally hydrated, simply because of what ketogenic diets do in terms of changes of metabolisms and metabolic rates and metabolites in circulation that can impact the way in which muscles function, that can impact the way in which nervous system functions, that can also impact my desire to consume fluids and the type of fluids that I'm consuming. So the last thing to look at here is the idea that surrounds the hydration issue. And once again, we're going to revisit the longer discussion on hydration here in a second. General rule of thumb that we're going to look at in terms of hydration and hydration status is the fact that if we want to make sure we're staying properly hydrated, it's more than just drinking water. We want to make sure that we're adding electrolytes to what we are drinking, a pinch of salt, a dash of sugar, the use of diluted sports drinks, consuming foods that have salts in them are all important during the summer months, as consuming salts is going to make us want to consume more fluids. But at the same time, consuming salts is going to help us offset or replace any electrolytes that get lost during the sweating that takes place, as I really don't want to throw out names here, but as the sports beverage commercials actually get something correct in their pitches, the loss of electrolytes in sweating actually impacts performance due to changes in hydration status and changes in ion balance around the excitable tissue, skeletal muscle, nervous tissue that can lead to a reduction in performance that can compromise our overall health and the ability to do healthy things during the summer months. One of the things that kind of gets brought up over and over and over again when you start looking at some of the kind of quick hit things on the internet as to what to watch out for during the summer months in terms of beverage consumption, they talk about don't consume caffeinated beverages. And once again, that's coming from a misconception, misnomer, and a misunderstanding of the data that's out there as it relates to caffeinated beverages. Caffeinated beverages do not dehydrate the body any more than water does it itself. Some of the adages say limit the amount of alcohol consumption. That's true because alcohol acts as a pure diuretic due to blocking of a hormone, ADH, antidiuretic hormone. And one of the things that gets recommended is that for every alcoholic beverage you consume a beverage of non-alcoholic or just regular water. The problem is that that consumption may not actually offset any of the diuretic effect that alcohol has, simply because we're now adding additional fluid into the body. And so one of the things you have to remember is that when we're looking at staying hydrated during the summer, we can rely a little bit on our thirst response. However, we have to remember is that with thirst response, we want to make sure that we're consuming 10 to 15% more than what stops us from being thirsty. So we start consuming liquid. If we stop being thirsty after 500 mils of fluid, we want to consume an additional 5 to 7 milliliters of fluid beyond that, simply to offset any of the shortcomings that happens within the feedback loop in that water consumption due to thirst response. And so with all of that kind of as the background, let's go ahead and revisit the discussion previously about hydration status and dehydration that is of importance as we go through the summer months, trying to stay as fit and as active as possible.
So we're going to continue looking at some issues relates to physiology, health, and well-being, going off of what we talked about in the Substack published earlier this week, looking at what do we need to know about hydration and hydrating. Kind of important topic given the current environmental conditions that we're facing in regards to the summer heat and the need to make sure that we are properly hydrating. So when we're looking at hydration, looking at hydrating, a couple of questions that we have to start to address. One of the things we have to look at is how much should I be drinking? We have some general recommendations. General recommendations that we have is somewhere around 4 ounces of water for every pound of body weight that we happen to have. If we look at it in terms of averages for our adult populations, that's somewhere around 3.7 or about 125 fluid ounces for males and about 2.7 liters or about 91 fluid ounces for females. Once again, those are just general recommendations for the population. It doesn't take into account any of the additional factors that might impact our hydration status. One of the things that will impact our hydration status is being active. This is not looking into what's happening in terms of activity out in the heat. This is just activity in general and the need to rehydrate following activity or to stay hydrated while we're being active. The general recommendation that we have based off of the scientific evidence is consuming somewhere between 0.4 and 0.8 liters, 400 milliliters to 800 milliliters per hour of exercise. And that value is going to be temperature and body mass dependent. Heavier individuals and individuals who are exercising in warmer environments will need to consume slightly higher in the range, whereas lighter individuals and individuals exercising in cooler environments may be consuming at the lower end of the range. We do know that in order to regain hydration status as being normally or UEU hydrated, we need to consume about 1.5 liters per kilogram of body mass loss during the exercise bout. If we look at it in terms of fluid ounces and pounds, that is about 23 to 23.1 fluid ounces per pound of body mass that is lost or body weight that's lost during the exercise. This is going to allow us to be able to regain mass that is lost. If we lose mass during an exercise, when we are looking at that mass is lost, it's not going to be the fat or the muscle or the carbohydrate mass that is being lost in very large amounts. What is going to be lost in large amounts during the exercise is going to be water. And most of that water is going to be lost in the sweat that is being produced in an attempt to cool the body off, as we need to make sure that we maintain a body temperature that is relatively stable, even though metabolic rate will be increasing during the exercise, elevating body temperature. And so that 1.5 liters or 23.1 fluid ounces that we'll be consuming per kilogram or per pound of body mass being lost is going to equate to the water mass that is being lost and that can be recollected during a rehydration following the exercise. And this is not something where you're going to consume all of it as fast as possible. You want to make sure you're consuming this over an hour to an hour and a half following the exercise event. Well, what about my morning or my afternoon or my evening coffee or caffeinated drink? Well, we know that moderate consumption of caffeine and of coffee has almost no impact on any of our hydration metrics. That is the urine-specific gravity, that is how dilute or how concentrated the urine happens to be for the person consuming the caffeinated beverage or the coffee. And we can state that based off of all of the empirical evidence that we have. If you're consuming coffee or a caffeinated beverage where caffeine is between 1.4 and 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram body mass, you're not going to see any type of diuretic effect or change in overall hydration. So it's not going to dehydrate you. There is some evidence to show that if I'm going to have a greater than 250 milligram per day consumption of the caffeine pills, that's the crystalline form of caffeine, I will have a moderate acute diuretic effect, which means that immediately following the consumption of that pill, I will increase the amount of urine being produced, which can cause a dehydrating effect to take place. But what most of the evidence is supporting is that if I am normally hydrated and consuming any of the caffeinated beverages or coffee, it's not going to have an impact on dehydrating my body, which means that out in the summer right now, having a coffee, having a tea, having an energy drink is not going to have a negative impact on your overall ability to stay hydrated as long as you're already staying hydrated. And so what we know is that there is the indication that normal consumption of caffeine and caffeinated beverages is not going to cause someone to be dehydrated, even though that tends to be the old wives' tale that we hear about and is generally stipulated in a lot of news stories that we might hear as relates to needing to stay hydrated during the summertime and in the heat to avoid the coffee, avoid the teas, avoid the caffeinated beverages. There are other things within some of the caffeinated beverages that we might want to avoid within the heat and while exercising, but it's not because it's going to cause a dehydration effect. And so the question we have to now ask is how much is too much? So we need to stay hydrated. We need to rehydrate our body while we're exercising, while we're being active, while we're being out in the heat. But how much is too much? Dehydration is associated With any body mass loss greater than 2% during an exercise, during activity. And so anytime I lose more than about 2% of my body mass, I will have experienced symptoms of dehydration. And we're going to need to replace that mass with fluid in order to overcome any of the issues with dehydration. The problem is I don't want to overconsume. Overconsumption can become just as big of an issue, if not bigger of an issue, than underconsumption of fluid. Overconsumption of fluid leads to dilution of body fluids, a scientific term that we use called hyponatremia. Hypo, lower than, natremia is referencing sodium. And so when we have too much fluid consumption, in particular, too much water consumption, what ends up happening is that we end up diluting the fluids of the body. We reduce the osmotic condition, the osmolarity, the concentrations, or what you think about as being the salinity of the body. And the body's salinity is about 0.9%. And so anytime I start to change the volumes that I'm either consuming or the volumes that I'm losing, I'm going to change that salinity. I'm going to change that concentration of salts relative to fluids. And so anytime I am consuming greater than 0.8 liters per hour of activity, I run the risk of developing that hyponatremia. And so while we want to consume fluids while we're exercising, while we're being active, we don't want to overconsume fluids. One of the things we want to make sure we're doing, particularly in the heat, is making sure that we're getting breaks from the heat itself. And during that break time from the heat itself, getting into shade, getting into cooled areas, cooling the body off to go ahead and undergo some form of rehydration during that period of time. But once again, we don't want to overconsume the fluids that we're consuming at that point in time. The reason why we don't want to overconsume is because we don't want to run the risk of becoming hyponatremic, but we want to make sure we're consuming enough to offset what's being lost so that we do not have that greater than 2% body mass loss. Getting into a cooled area or getting out of direct sun into a shaded area is going to help us out because it's going to reduce water loss in sweat, as we're going to give our body a chance to remove some of the extra heat source. That would be the sunlight. And by reducing the heat source, we're able to dissipate, remove extra heat a little bit easier than what we would be otherwise. So how do I know if I'm properly hydrated? What are the signs and symptoms I'm going to look for to let me know that I am dehydrated or that I'm not consuming enough fluids in order to maintain my normal hydration status? Well, we'll see dry mouth. Dry mouth is important because it's going to drive us to want to drink. But if I start experiencing dry mouth, that's an indication that I'm not being properly hydrated. Looking at my urine color and looking at my urine volume, it's a combination of both color and volume here, not just color and not just volume. As the color and the volume of urine, there's a whole bunch of factors that come into play. But if I am dehydrated, I'm going to be producing a very small volume of urine. And because I'm producing a small volume of urine, the solids that are in the urine will start to coalesce around each other and become more opaque, become darker, where I will start to go from having a pale yellow colored urine, which is a normal color urine, towards a more kind of brownish yellow, amber color, towards a brownish urine, particularly as I become even more dehydrated. Along with that color chart, scientifically, we'll look at things known as urine specific gravity. And that is the relationship or the density relationship between urine and water, where water has a specific gravity of 1.00000. And normal urine is going to be between 1.004 and 1.010, where a normally hydrated person will have a urine specific gravity up to about 1.020. Once we start getting above that 1.020, we start having to worry about dehydration issues for that person. Combined with the dry mouth, we will also start seeing changes in skin conditions where skin can become very dry and very blotchy. We may also start seeing crystalline forms of sweat collecting on the skin as the person's fluid volume will drop, but sweat will still be produced, just not as much sweat as what would normally be produced. We'll see changes in fatigue. Person can become tired, more easily. We'll see a change in mood. Irritability can come about. Headaches can develop, all based off of changes in fluid volume of the cerebrospinal fluid. That's the fluid that surrounds the brain. And if I lose the fluid surrounding the brain, the neurons that make up the brain start behaving differently. But we'll also see changes in blood pressure in and around those areas, which can trigger various types of headaches. I'll see changes in bowel movements. Constipation is one of the things that can come about if I'm not being properly hydrated. The constipation tends to be more of a chronic, prolonged issue with poorly hydrated individuals. So if I know that I'm out and about in the summer heat and I'm not normally hydrating myself, on day one, on day two, on day three, as I progress towards day three, I may start end up having constipation issues. And a lot of those constipation issues can be corrected by increasing my hydration status, by increasing how hydrated my body happens to be. Now, one of the things we have to remember is that when we're consuming fluids, we want to make sure that it's more than just water. Remember, we're going to be losing electrolytes along with the water that we're losing or having removed from the body. We'll lose electrolytes and we'll lose other solutes in the form of sweat, in urine, as well as in a lot of the intestinal secretions. When we start seeing changes in our hydration, we're going to start seeing changes in the concentration of these secretions, as well as how much fluid we happen to have in our blood and how much fluid we happen to have in the fluid that surrounds the tissues of the body. And so why are we going to have to worry about those electrolytes? And why, if we look at the drinks that we consume that are mass marketed for hydration purposes, are they adding sugars and adding electrolytes? And this is where we have to go back to the chemistry and go back to the physiology. Sodium as an ion has a very large, what's called hydration sphere that has the ability to be surrounded by a lot of water molecules. And because it has a large hydration sphere and because it wants to attract a large number of water molecules, we make this kind of claim. And the claim that we make is wherever sodium moves, water will follow it. And it does this in such a way so as to maintain normal salinity and normal levels of water concentrations in the body. And that's simply because of the hydration sphere, the ability for water molecules to surround the sodium atom much more than a lot of the other ions that we happen to have or electrolytes that we happen to have in our diet and within our body. Now, what's interesting is that we'll also add things like glucose and fructose. Now, sometimes you'll read things like dextrose on labels. And dextrose is just another form of glucose. And what dextrose or glucose and what fructose have is when it gets transported into the cells, particularly the cells that are lining the intestine, as it gets absorbed in those cells, it moves across the cell membrane, water molecules are going to follow along with it. And that's because we have what's referred to as a symport action. That means that the molecules are going to move in the same direction across the membrane. And so what ends up happening is that the sodium and the sugar will move in the direction from the intestines into the cell and then into the body. And what that movement does is it's going to draw water to it. And so we can consider these molecules to have water drawing ability. That means they're going to create a condition that's going to make water want to follow or move along with it. And so what the sports drinks or the electrolyte drinks are doing is that they're creating a condition that's going to allow for more water to be absorbed to offset the water that's being lost or fluids being lost during activity so as to keep our concentrations normal. And we want to make sure our concentrations are normal so that we have normal actions of all of the cells of the body. So we get normal muscle contractions, normal neuron functions, so that we're able to keep our performance up. Now, what these don't do is these do not give a performance benefit. We don't all of a sudden go from being a bench warmer to an all-star simply because we're consuming these drinks. But what it does do is it does allow us to maintain the performance that we happen to have when dehydration starts to come into play. And I'm going to consume these beverages. But once again, it's not going to give me a performance benefit. It's simply going to make sure that my performance doesn't drop off faster than what's already dropped off. So what about the drinks and the concentrations of the materials that I'm getting beyond just the fluid? I'm going to give you some numbers here, and the numbers are based off of serving sizes, and serving sizes are typically given in terms of about a 12 to 16 ounce container, sometimes up to a 750 milliliter container. Now, the American College of Sports Medicine and a couple of the other academic societies have come up with a general recommendation for fluid replacement beverages to contain somewhere around 20 to 30 mill equivalents of sodium, which is around 400 milligrams of sodium, 20 to 30 mill equivalents of chloride, which is once again somewhere around 400 milligrams of chloride, 2 to 5 mill equivalents of potassium. That 2 to 5 mill equivalents of potassium is going to give me somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 200 milligrams of potassium, and around 5 to 10% carbohydrates. If we look at what the mass marketed beverages are going to give us, we have some ranges. Carbohydrates are going to range from about 1 gram per serving to about 30 grams per serving, depending upon whether we're going to get the quote unquote zero form or the normal sugared form. Sodium is going to be between 160 and 480 milligrams per serving. Chlorides will range from about 200 to 700 milligrams per serving. Potassium is going to range between 50 and 470 milligrams per serving. Magnesium is going to be between 10 and 40 milligrams per serving. Calcium between 10 and 120 milligrams per serving. Zinc between 2.8 and 4 milligrams per serving. And phosphorus between 40 and 140 milligrams per serving. All of these fit within the range that is given for optimal drink composition based off of what the academic societies have given us, with the exception of carbohydrates in the zero form. Now, the carbohydrates in the zero form will use a different form of sugar that is not measured in our carbohydrate counts. There are still carbohydrates there. It's just not the carbohydrates that we use in terms of counting carbohydrates. They will still act very similar to the glucose and the fructose in terms of their ability to draw water, which means they're still going to have that rehydration effect. But what they don't do is they do not provide the nutrient for energetic purposes during the exercise event. So how much is too much? Well, we have maximums that we have to worry about for a lot of the electrolytes, because when we start having too much of certain electrolytes, we'll have changes in performance effects. And so a maximum amount of sodium is about 4 grams or 4,000 milligrams per day. Potassium is about 4.2 grams or 4,200 milligrams per day. Chlorine is about 4,200 milligrams or 4.2 grams per day. Calcium is about 2.5 grams or 2,500 milligrams per day. We don't have a necessary maximum for magnesium. However, we do not want to consume over about 4 to 4.25 grams per day. But there's no indicated maximal value that we want to have. Phosphorus, we have a maximum value of about 4 grams per day. And zinc, we have a maximum value of about 0.4 grams per day. And these values correspond with the major, minor, and trace elements that we have within our diet in terms of the elements that we have. We don't want to overconsume electrolytes, particularly don't want to overconsume sodium, as overconsumption of sodium can lead to retention of fluids. Now, even though we're talking about hydration issues here and the wanting to make sure that we're staying properly hydrated, overconsuming of sodium has been linked with hypertension, high blood pressure, that is associated with excessive blood volume and excessive interstitial volume. And it goes back to, if you look at the Substack, the passage there as it relates to volume of fluids within the tissues and within the body. We only have so much fluid that is found outside the cell. And it's about 37% of all of the fluid in the body is found outside the cells of the body. And that fluid volume is important because it's going to establish our membrane potentials. And sodium is found predominantly outside cells of the body. It's found in the interstitial or the extracellular compartments outside the cells or in the areas surrounding the tissue. And so if I'm overconsuming sodium, it's going to lead to retention of fluids, but it's also going to change concentrations, particularly concentrations of sodium ions around membranes, which can lead to issues as relates to membrane functions and cell function. And so even though we want to make sure that we're getting sodium and getting potassium and getting chlorine and getting calcium and getting magnesium and getting phosphorus and getting zinc and iodine and a whole bunch of the other ions in the beverages that we're consuming while we are rehydrating, we want to make sure we don't overconsume it. And so if you are someone that's going to consume a lot of the electrolyte beverages, you want to make sure that you are not over consuming electrolytes in the beverages. And that's simply because we can get these things in other places. We can get fluids and we can get electrolytes in things besides the beverages that we are going to consume. We will get a lot of fluids and a lot of electrolytes from the fruits and vegetables that we eat. We will get a lot of our salts from the salting of food, adding table salt, whether it is the iodized table salt or the Himalayan pink salt or the kosher salt or the flake salt. All of those salt that we add to all of the foods that we eat is going to add to our electrolyte balance, going to add to how much electrolyte we happen to have being consumed. We will also get it within the meats and the dairy that we consume. And the other thing we have to remember is that some of the foods that we eat are going to want to make us drink more, want us to overconsume fluid. Salty foods and snacks. Salty foods and snacks is part of the salt crave. It's something that happens when I am dehydrated. I actually want to have salt. And that want for salts is so that I'm going to increase how much fluid I'm drinking. And so if I'm going to eat chips, if I'm going to eat pretzels, if I'm going to eat things that are salty, I'm going to be drinking more to offset the changes in the dryness or wetness of my mouth that's associated with eating those foods. As salts found on those foods will lead to dehydration of the mouth. Because of how we digest and absorb any of the carbohydrates in our diet, eating carbohydrate or starchy food is going to change the way in which my body is hydrated. So if I'm someone that is following one of the popular low carbohydrate ketogenic diet, I have less carbohydrate in my diet, which means that I'm going to be absorbing less water, which means I'm going to need to somehow offset the solids, the solutes, the salts, and the other things I'm going to have in my fluids to make sure that I'm able to get more hydrated, as the inability to absorb extra water from having not a lot of carbohydrates or starchy food can impact my hydration status. And so if I'm out exercising in the summer heat and I am following a keto diet or I'm following a low carbohydrate diet, I run the risk of becoming dehydrated faster than someone who is following a normal carbohydrate diet, even if I'm consuming some of those zero beverages that the sports drinks peoples will be producing. So we talked about the sports drinks, what we see in the sports drinks. We talked about hydrating and being normally hydrated in the volumes that we can consume stuff. The other thing we have to remember is that we don't have to spend the money on the sports drink. I know that the sports drinks people don't want to hear this. If we know the science, we can make it ourselves. We don't want to oversalt things. So if you look at the concentrations of a lot of the sports drinks, a lot of the sports drinks are concentrated at about 0.045% to about 0.6% in terms of their concentrations. We can, if we are going to be environmentally conscious and use our own reusable bottle, we can make a sports drink that can last us the entire day by simply just refilling and partially diluting the fluids that we're going to be consuming. And so we want to end up making a solution that over time is going to be equivalent to my body concentration, which is going to be about 0.9%. And that's done in a combination of salts and sugars. And so what's that mean? That means that for every liter bottle that I have, I want to add about 0.5 gram of table salt and about 0.5 gram of whatever sweetener I'm going to use, whether it's a sugar or another type of sweetener. I can also use any type of flavoring that's going to help make the drink more palatable, simply because even at this lower than body concentration, that level of salt will taste very salty. And what this is going to do is this is going to increase my ability to stay hydrated and reach normal hydration status. A very interesting story that came about from the military operations that the U.S. Army had and the U.S. Marine Corps had in the Middle East was the need to make sure that the soldiers stayed hydrated, given the environmental conditions of the Middle East and the military equipment that they had to wear. And what they found out is that if they were to put just the normal packet of
salt that you might get from a fast food restaurant, and a normal packet of sugar and flavoring that you might get from the powdered flavored drinks that you can get at any of the supermarkets. And if they put that into the camel packs or the water canteens for the soldiers and the Marines, they found out that they had less incidences of dehydration taking place. And so they didn't go out and spend the hundreds and thousands and millions of dollars on the sports drinks. They were making it themselves. And you can do the exact same thing in your own kitchen. You don't have to go out and spend all of the money on the sports drinks. You can go ahead and make it yourself, and you can make it to whatever palatable taste that you want to make it. You can add whatever flavor you want to add to it. We can talk about the citric, the adding of the citrus wedges into the table water. While it's not going to overly change much of the chemistry of the water, it will make it slightly more palatable. And by making it slightly more palatable, it will make you want to drink. The whole idea here in terms of hydration and getting a drink beverage that you want to drink is to make you want to drink it. What we have to remember is that when we're drinking our fluids, it's not about what type of fluid that we're drinking per se. It's the fact that we're drinking fluids. As even when we are looking at the soft drinks, the caffeinated beverages, the juices, whether it's with the artificial juices or whether it is made at home from fruit juice, the majority of that liquid is going to be water. And since the majority of that liquid is going to be water, I'm going to be making sure that I am rehydrating myself. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you happen to be on the YouTube watching this, I hope that you learned a little bit. Hope you came away with some new ideas.